Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How different would the world be if every child had access to a world-class education? And what role might 21st century technology play in making that possible? My guest this hour took a highly unorthodox route to his career as a champion of global education. Salman Khan had worked with Silicon Valley startups and as a hedge fund analyst when he offered to tutor a 12-year-old cousin who was struggling in math. Because his cousin lived 1,500 miles away, Khan experimented with a number of technological solutions for helping her learn. And as other relatives and then complete strangers began to use the same lessons, Khan realized he had the basic elements for making a truly great education available to students anywhere in the world at no cost to them. And that process would start with addressing what is broken about the modern education system. Salman Khan is founder of the Khan Academy and author of the new book, The One World Schoolhouse, Education Reimagined. Salman, welcome to Think.
Great to be here.
One thing that makes this story so remarkable is that when it started, you had no grand vision of changing the world. Talk about how you decided to step up and help your cousin Nadia and why you relied on technology to do that.
Yeah, I talk a lot about it in the book, but, you know, I've always had a kind of an interest in education. I had some attempts in college to write educational software and things like that. And when my cousin was having trouble with math, I kind of viewed that as an opportunity to understand the problem a little bit more, because she seemed like a very bright girl, very hardworking, but she was having trouble with sixth grade mathematics. So I started tutoring her, and it started to become very clear very early on that despite the fact that she had kind of done everything right in her life, she had all these gaps in her knowledge. She was entering seventh grade at the time, but even some basic arithmetic, some basic with negative numbers, fractions, she knew it just kind of okay, and that was what was keeping her from being able to understand more advanced things. And when you think about a traditional academic model, it pretty much ensures that those gaps show up in people's learning. If we're in a classroom and we are, let's say, learning about exponents, at the end of the week, we all have an exam. I might get a B, you might get an A, our friend might get a C. And even though the gaps were identified in our friend that got a C, or even in me, the guy got a B, we then move on to the next concept. Maybe it's negative exponents, or maybe it's logarithm, something that builds on the more fundamental concept. And so these gaps just accumulate, and that's why we see so many students, like my cousin at the time and so many others, that once they get to algebra, once they get to calculus, that really assumes that you mastered everything that came before it, they struggle with it. And so what I write a lot about in the book is, well, now with technology, we can enter a reality where instead of holding fixed that everyone learns at the same pace and the variable being how well they learn it, we can hold fixed that everyone actually masters the concepts and the variable is how well they learn, is how long they have to learn it, when they learn it, and where they learn it.
So if it takes me three times of repeating the same lesson to get to where I have an A and clearly understand it completely, that's fine.
That's fine. You know, it's amazing. Sometimes I get those questions when I give talks. It's like, well, what if it takes a student 2 years to get algebra, 3 years to get algebra? I was, well, that's how long it should take them. It's better to really master algebra than to have a superficial understanding of algebra, which most students now have. Then they go move on to algebra 2, have even a more superficial understanding of algebra 2, then an even more superficial understanding of pre-calculus. Calculus, half the people I know who've taken it, they can't really explain what the class was even about. What's the whole point of the subject? And so, exactly right. You're much better off mastering the core concept so that you understand it, you see the connections to the world, you can apply it in your everyday life.
So how did we end up with a school model that dominates not just public school education in the U.S., but frankly a lot of private schools here and around the world where you have groups of students separated by age, sitting in rows, listening to lectures for a fixed amount of time, and then moving on to the next thing?
Yeah, I go at length into kind of the history of this, and the history is, even while I was doing the research for it, it's surprising and surprisingly interesting. Many of us know that, you know, the lectures can go probably even further back, but definitely to the ancient Greeks. But few people realize that our model of education, this notion of public education, it can be dated back to the Prussian Empire, late 18th century Prussians. They're the first that said, hey, we want to do public education, which is a very noble goal. They said, well, how do we do it? And it was the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. They said, well, how do we do anything in the Industrial Revolution? We put things into batches. We have them move along an assembly line. At each station, we try to apply some things. Bells ring every hour or so to kind of separate shifts. And once the products are made, we kind of say, okay, those oranges are meant for the organic store, and those oranges are going to be crushed for orange juice. And so they said, well, we'll do the same model for it with our kids. And so we said, well, how do we batch them? Well, age seemed most obvious. And how do we separate subjects? Well, we'll just define it in some way. We'll have a bell ring every hour, and they'll just go together at the same pace, pretty much ensuring some of what I just talked about, some of those gaps. And so that model was we inherited in the mid-1800s when the U.S. also, with a very noble goal, said we want to do free public education. And this probably was the most reasonable way to do it at the time. And then in 1892, few people realize this is a bunch of university presidents headed by the president of Harvard, 10 guys, literally guys, sat together and said, well, we need to standardize what public education is. And they were the men in 1892 that decided that your first year of high school, you will learn algebra, followed by geometry, followed by algebra 2, then you will do this in trigonometry, then you will you'll learn your physics your last year in high school, chemistry your second to last year. And what they defined over about 120 years ago has not changed since that date.
Nor has the fact that students are off for the most part for weeks and months over the summer.
Right. I talk a lot about it in the book, and I always tell people, hear me out. I'm not a complete, you know, prude here. But I, you know, summer vacation is a huge waste. And many people know it comes out of the most of the world being a kind of an agrarian society where kids had to help out on the farm over the summer. But most of the world is now an urbanized civilization where they don't need to do that. And you might say, well, you know, summer is a time for, you know, kids to kind of, you know, do their own thing. And what I point out in the book is that actually should be throughout the year should be times of exploration. Kids should be able to do creativity. But the bottom line is right now in summer, you have school buildings, you have very talented teachers who aren't being utilized. And you have kids who are forgetting a lot of what they know over that summer. And if you're affluent, you might be able to get your kid into a kind of an interesting summer camp. And I think those interesting summer camps are frankly what all of schools should look like. But for most middle class or lower middle class or underserved students, they're left kind of fending for themselves during the summer.
And it's those students who are lower performing and lower income that have the most to lose and that, in fact, do, according to research, lose the most of their knowledge over the summer. They lose more, in fact, than those affluent kids that you mentioned that get into the fancy summer camps.
Yeah, you know, it's back to this gap issue. Is a lot of the students, and we've seen it in the data, we've worked with some schools here in Oakland, California, where we saw middle school kids in Oakland who had trouble with their multiplication tables. And those gaps get even worse if they go 3-4 months of a year where they're not engaged in math or science or academics at all.
So you read like 19th century novels and things, and there's always a character in those that has a private tutor. Is that how we did education before we got to the Prussian model, when we could afford it?
That's exactly right. If we go 300 years ago, and if you had the resources, if you were king or lord and you wanted to educate your children, you would get them a private tutor. And that private tutor would not batch those children into these age cohorts and just give a lecture and then just hope that kid gets it and maybe the kid gets a C on that concept and then move on to the next concept. A private tutor would never do that. The private tutor would say, well, this kid's going to be the king one day. We have to make sure he really understands these concepts. And so he would sit with the child who understands their knowledge state and make sure that they really mastered concepts. And now that was never practical if you're trying to do mass education without technology. But now that we have technology is really good at coordinating, see where every student is, measuring where that student is, and giving them resources. But the one thing I point out a lot in the book, it's not a virtual versus physical. It's a virtual to empower physical. I still imagine the best possible academic experience is having a connection with your peers and your teachers, but you can use virtual tools like the Khan Academy to really make sure you master your subjects, have a first pass at a lot of them, and to give the teacher information on where you are so that they can really customize instruction.
Okay, we've talked a little bit about history, a little bit about education theory. Tell us how you went from tutoring your cousin Nadia and her brothers to having students all over the world, 3,500 classes online. How did this all come about?
Well, I you know, those early days while I was tutoring them, and word got around in the family that free tutoring was happening. So fast forward about 18 months, and I was tutoring about 15 of my cousins and family friends every day after work. And I was initially I worked on the software part of Khan Academy, which is still a big part of us, on giving them problems, me as their tutor being able to see what they were able to do, what they weren't able to do. But a friend of mine suggested, hey, why don't you make some YouTube videos to supplement the software that you're writing, supplement your tutorials. And I was immediately dismissive. I said, no, you know, YouTube is for cats playing piano. It's not for serious mathematics But I got over the idea that it wasn't my idea, and I gave it a shot. And, you know, long story short, it became clear in a matter of months, really, that people who were not my cousins were starting to watch, and they started to send thank you letters and testimonials, and I started to get really excited about it. So I just kept making videos. And then by 2009, I frankly had trouble focusing on my day job. And so I write a lot about this in the book. My wife and I, we met and we're like, well, you know, we had a little bit of savings, so maybe I should try to do this. I set up as a not-for-profit. Hopefully someone would notice and fund this thing.
Why a not-for-profit? Because one thing you also discovered was that people with lots of resources were recommending this to their own kids, and clearly you could have made a nice, tidy sum for yourself selling these classes in the same way that people buy tutoring for their kids and SAT classes and that sort of thing. What convinced you that the right way to do this was to keep it free for the users?
Yeah, you know, well, there's nothing free doesn't necessarily free could have been done as a for profit. Google gives away things for free. Facebook gives away things for free. For me, and there are not for profits that actually do charge money. Obviously, a Stanford University or a Harvard, they are happy to charge a lot of tuition of people.
Sure.
For me, the difference between not for profit and for profit is what happens in over the long term. When things get tough, what does the organization focus on as its true bottom line? And as a not-for-profit, no one owns a not-for-profit. It's owned essentially by its mission. And so my thinking was, well, there's nothing wrong with a for-profit. If Khan Academy is a for-profit, maybe a lot of people would use it. Maybe it generates revenue at some point. Maybe it IPOs and I could be, you know, become wealthy and maybe buy some new clothes, which wouldn't be bad. Nothing wrong with that. But I sat and thought. I thought about all of the reward I was getting from people saying thank you for this. I said, well, I never want a barrier for anyone or anywhere in the world to access this stuff. And I also want this to be available well past the time that I'm there. And in the for-profit world, I mean, my old job was as an analyst at an investment firm, so I understood this very well. In the for-profit world, you had constant changes of control. It went from a parent to their children, and who knows what their children did with the content, or they might have sold it to someone else, and that when it gets sold to the other company might kill it or just put it in some stock room someplace and never sees the light of day. And I also thought about, well, what are the institutions that have been able to last multi-generation and focus on their mission? And they are all universally not-for-profits. And then on top of that, if you think about education and the vision of Khan Academy is really to be an education institution, one that makes education like clean drinking water, that anyone can have it. It's just an expectation. It's truly respected education institutions. Very few of them, or I would argue none of them, are coming from the for-profit sector.
What did you learn as you began to experiment with different media for teaching these lessons about what worked and what didn't?
Yeah, well, I made them, you know, I was just experimenting very on the fly, off the cuff, so to speak. You know, those first few videos for Nadia, when I was doing the tutoring sessions with her, we would just be over a speakerphone, we would just hear each other's voices, and we had a shared scratch pad that we found some tools on the internet that allowed us to do that. And it seemed to work. We just heard each other's voices. We saw our writing. It felt like we were next to each other at the kitchen table. And so when I made my first videos, I said, well, I actually did not have a video camera. And even if I did, I said, well, then I would get all self-conscious and I would feel like I'd have to pluck my eyebrows and everything else. And so I said, well, you know, let me just do the same thing that I've been doing with Nadia. Let me just write on a screen on this kind of virtual blackboard. And then people can hear my voice and they can stay focused on the content. And I remember I uploaded the first video to YouTube in 2006, and it was like 12 minutes long, and it got rejected because it was too long. It had to be 10 minutes or less. And so I said, okay, I guess it has to be less than 10 minutes. And I realized that 10 minutes was about perfect to get a nugget of an idea across. And if you had to cover many ideas, you can just do many, many, many 10-minute videos. So even though the content is in 10-minute chunks, it's actually more exhaustive than your typical, what's often covered in a textbook or a traditional course.
We're going to take a quick break. My guest is Salman Khan, founder of the Khan Academy and author of the new book, The One World Schoolhouse, Education Reimagined. You can join us now at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Salman Khan. He is founder of the Khan Academy and author of the new book, The One World Schoolhouse, Education Reimagined. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Salman, I'm seeing our board start to light up with calls, and I think it's important for us to jump in here and stress that you are not trying to put teachers out of work. In fact, you want to see them paid better, more respected for the hard work that they do, and utilized more effectively than they are today.
Yeah, I mean, to a large degree, that was the whole one of the major points of the book, and obviously just to paint a larger vision, but also to make it very clear, whenever, you know, we've gotten a lot of good press, but sometimes when people see this press about, oh, there's this virtual thing that's talking about changing education, is that going to replace physical things? Is it going to be Amazon.com versus Barnes & Noble? And everything I write about, everything that I talk about is, no, it's the exact opposite. The classrooms that are using Khan Academy and 20,000 that are using them, the teachers are becoming more valuable. They're not giving this kind of passive lecture. They're now able to get data. They're able to cater things directly to a student's needs. They're finding themselves to be invigorated. Every classroom is different now. They're able to form better bonds with the students, and the students also feel it, a better connection. They feel like they're on the same side with the teacher now. So everything I talk about is, how can technology not be, you know, the last thing we want is that somehow it'd be a replacement, but for it to actually empower teachers, to make the classroom more human, not less human.
Explain the flipped classroom model and how that can work with the materials that you've put up on Khan Academy.
You know, early on, this was in 2007, 2008, when I had several hundred videos up there, maybe it was 1,000 at that point, I got letters and emails from teachers saying, well, you know, you've given an interesting lesson on the quadratic formula or an interesting lesson on systems of equations. I don't want to use my scarce class time doing that same thing over again. I'm now having my students watch it at their own time and pace, and that way if they need remediation, or if they have some questions, they can pause it, they can look at other videos, they can look up stuff on the internet. And when they come to the classroom, we focus purely on problem solving, because in the teacher's mind, and in my mind as well, that's where the learning really happens. And so traditionally, problem solving was meant for homework, and you had to do it by yourself. If you didn't have parents or siblings that could help you, you were kind of stuck. And when you went to class, you did this very passive thing. Even though you got 30 people in a room together, they weren't talking to each other. They were just passively looking like they were listening to a lecture. If you do it the other way around, when you come to class, everyone's actively engaged. The teacher is not just talking at the student. The teacher is working with the students and sees where all the students are. And now the students can work with each other as well. And one thing I point out in the book is, as soon as you do that slight change, it actually opens up the door to do even more profound things, because the lecture forced you to go at the same pace because it was the only way that you were communicating the information. If you take the lecture out of the classroom, one, the classroom becomes much more human and interactive. But now you can imagine a reality where the kids all learn at their own pace, and you don't have this issue with the gaps accumulating like we mentioned earlier.
And how is that different from the traditional method of saying, okay, make sure you've read chapter 4 before you come in on Wednesday?
You know, it's very similar, actually. You know, I point out to the book, none of these ideas are new, and they have been used in certain contexts. In business schools have famously been using case studies for a long time. Students read cases on their own time, and class is all about an interactive conversation. A lot of humanities seminars have been doing this for some time, you know, do the reading, and when we come to class, we're going to have a conversation. Unfortunately, this hasn't been the case for kind of the mainstream courses. This hasn't been the case for the kind of the science and math courses that almost everyone has to take. It hasn't been the case for, if you take freshman calculus at your local university, it's likely to still be 300 people in a lecture hall trying to take notes, as opposed to people trying to work with each other and problem solve.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Sharmina in Richardson. Hi, Sharmina.
Hi, thank you so much for the show. It's a wonderful topic. I was really interested because my son is actually doing the videos on the KhanAcademy.com. And my question was regarding, some children are doing specialized programs. Like, my son is actually trying to memorize the Quran full time. So he goes to school half a day to do that, and I'm trying to homeschool him. And I was wondering whether Mr. Khan thought it was possible to just complete an academic year just by following the videos online, or would I actually need to supplement him with more, and how would that work, and what does he feel about homeschooling?
Thanks for your call.
So our view is, we want to be if someone has a physical environment, and we hope they do because we think that gives a more holistic experience, we want to be what we call an exhaustive supplement. But if someone has nothing else, that they could use the videos and the exercise. Most of our team is actually working on the interactive side of Khan Academy to get a pretty solid foundation in that topic. My ideal, I have young children, and kind of what I envision for them is that they do go to a physical school, but when they go to a classroom, it's not lecture-based, and it's not passive. They're actively engaged. They're helping other friends. They're tutoring them. They're working directly with the teacher. And then they use tools like the Khan Academy to give them the kind of academic scaffold and make sure that they understand those concepts.
You know, one thing that I thought was terrific when I was poking around on the site was that you have test prep work that people can do on Khan Academy, which is something that a lot of people worry keeps students who are very bright but are not of significant means from getting into the best schools because they haven't had the special Kaplan course or something.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, you know, things like the SAT, it's called an aptitude test. So in theory, you know, it's just kind of like how capable are you? But we all know that you can prepare for these things. And if you have the right background and if you have access to the right courses, you can prepare pretty heavily for these type of things. And, you know, in those early days when some people were trying to convince me to make this for profit, they're like, oh, yeah, well, everything will be free, but we'll charge for test prep. We'll charge for this or that. And I was like, no, that's the exact opposite point of what I'm trying to do. If you think that somehow that's higher value or that's the stuff that's going to determine students' fates, then that's the stuff that we have to make sure that every student has access to. And so, yeah, on Khan Academy, I've worked through all 405 math problems on 10 different SATs. I've worked through a bunch of GMAT problems. Not to be a test prep site, the whole focus of Khan Academy is really to prepare you for life, and there's videos on cosmology and accounting and biology. But there is that dimension that, look, if you do want to make sure that you're prepared for college or graduate school, we also have you there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Robbie on the line next in Plano. Hey, Robbie.
Hello. Hi. Thank you so much, Mr. Khan. It's really nice to talk with you. I recently saw a video where Mr. Negroponte of One Laptop Per Child, he dropped a bunch of laptops in middle of nowhere in Ethiopia and with no instructions, nothing. And soon the kids had not only figured out how to use it, but they were actually learning English and could recite the alphabet. And this is absolutely middle of nowhere with zero literacy. So I was wondering if you have thought of using your videos as sort of a predictor for aptitude that a student might adopt as a career in future. So you give them a bunch of videos, see what they gravitate towards, and then follow them, and then kind of at the end of their high school, starting from grade 9 to grade 12, kind of say that, okay, maybe this is something that you might like because, you know, you've been paying more attention to this. And then, you know, go on from there. My other question was that if you have some videos that might be subtitled in other languages.
Thanks so much for your call.
So on both of those dimensions, and I completely agree. I mean, you know, as powerful as some of these things could be in the developed world, they could be game changers in the developing world. And I write a lot about that in the book. People are already taking some of our content, random parts of the world. I got emails in this past year from Mongolia. There's a group that's actually taking Khan Academy into orphanages in Mongolia. And to your point about aptitude, you know, there's one girl, orphanage for girls, and there's a 15-year-old Zaya who started using Khan Academy just to learn initially. But she herself, one, felt prepared, but then got inspired. And now at 17, she's the main producer of Khan Academy math and science videos in the Mongolian language. And so we could imagine, and we do imagine, a world where, you know, students anywhere on the planet have access to this at minimum. And we can look, you know, we see the data in real time, and we can start to see kids that are off the charts, let the Ministry of Education in the country know, look, there's something special that we got to make sure that kid gets off the streets and someone actually invests in them. And part of that, if we really want to make it accessible for everyone, is make sure it's localized, make sure it's in every language. And we started the translation effort. We have 3,400 videos in English. But we actually have 7,000 videos in other languages. And I don't want to just say translations because a lot of them were redone in other languages. And so we already have 800 videos in Spanish, I think 900 in Portuguese. We have several hundred in Bengali, Hindi, Urdu. And our goal is to cover everything, and over the next 5 or 10 years to really be localized into every major language. And our hope is, especially as the technology gets cheaper, broadband gets more accessible, you know, within 10 or 20 years, every student on the planet has access to this type of resource.
What have you learned, Salman, about the best way to assess student mastery of particular topics?
Well, yeah, you know, well, I talk a lot in the book about, look, you know, students should be proficient or at minimum proficient or maybe master a concept before they try to tackle more advanced ones. But it does make you wonder, well, how do you define mastery? And in the early days when I was building stuff for my cousins, I just kind of said, oh, 10 in a row. And then you say, oh, what type of question and things like that. Now what we're doing at Khan Academy, we're getting a little bit more or a lot more sophisticated about it. We have an analytics team. As students do exercises, we're able to log it, and we can see statistically how likely they are to perform on similar exercises or completely different exercises. And that so that knowledge state, the probability that they know concept X, Y, or Z, we can continuously update. And once it meets a certain threshold, we're like, okay, at least for now, it seems like that student's proficient. And I stress at least for now, because this is the other thing that's lost in the traditional model. You might be able to ace a test. You might know something 100% on week one, but especially if the summer goes by or a couple of other weeks or you get distracted, you lose a lot of that information. I mean, most of us now can't even list the courses we took in college, much less remember what was actually taught in them. And so one thing that we emphasize is we want retention to be a big part of it. We already see in the data this kind of learning decay that happens. And so the ideal is that we ping someone at the right moment to make sure that they're retaining a lot of that information.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We are speaking with Khan Academy founder Salman Khan, author of the new book, The One World Schoolhouse. Let's go next on the phone to Corinth, and we have Michelle on the line. Hey, Michelle.
Hi. I have a question for Mr. Khan. I spent 10 years substitute teaching, and my son is a junior in high school, and he has gone through and now out of the Advanced Placement Program. And I find that Advanced Placement, rather than helping the kids learn anything more advanced or better, just teaches them how to be little Hoovers and suck it up and spit it out, which I think is actually damaging to some of these kids. And I wanted Mr. Khan's opinion on advanced placement.
Yeah, you know, I go at some length. It's hard as a parent because to some degree you have to kind of play by the current rules of the game, because APs, the colleges look at them, they give your student credit, and it's also used even for college admissions. But the problem with it is, and actually this isn't just APs, but I think APs are an example of this. They tend to have a lot of work involved in the courses, but when you have a lot of work, and I talk about this book, especially a lot of homework, it actually squeezes out potentially more valuable things that you could be doing with your time. You know, I quote in the book a student who was asked by the admissions officer, "What do you daydream about?" And the student says, "I don't daydream about anything. It doesn't get me into college." And I think that's kind of, I think, what you're alluding to when you ask that question. So in the ideal, you know, so in the current reality, to some degree, you have to play that game and make sure your student, you know, does the AP material, hopefully retains it, hopefully gets it at a deeper level. But I would like to see a reality where, yes, you can prove competency on something like, you know, at the same level of rigor as AP Calculus or AP Physics or AP World History, but that's not your entire academic dimension, or that's not the only dimension that you're assessed on. That's one dimension. Another dimension is your portfolio of creative work, things that you've actually created. For me, AP Computer Science, what you got on that exam, that's nice, but I'd rather see what you actually created. Or AP Art History, that's interesting, or AP English, but I'd rather see what you've written or what you've critically analyzed. And then the third dimension, which I think is really important and completely lost in current systems, is the dimension of your ability to help others. And it's not just a nice feel-good thing, oh, did that person help? But that's indicative of very important life skills. Can you communicate? Can you empathize? Do you understand the material deeply enough to distill it down for someone else?
One of those other, I don't know if it's a skill, but certainly a value in life, is self-motivation. And maybe everybody listening today has kids who run home from school and can't wait to enhance their knowledge. But talk, Salman, about what we've learned about motivating kids who think they don't like school, they are not engaged, and how this material can make a difference.
One big surprise for me when I started this whole project, inadvertently for my cousins, is I was like, okay, you know, maybe this will work for my cousins who seem pretty motivated. Maybe it'll work for the 13-year-old version of me. I was pretty motivated when I was in school. And I imagined it was, you know, for 5 or 20% of students. And the big learning for me has been, no, that was actually a false idea, that far more students can be motivated. It's just that they tend to disengage from their classrooms really just to protect their self-esteem. If you have all of these gaps in your knowledge, if you don't know your multiplication tables and you're in an algebra class, the only way that you can defend your self-esteem is to say, well, I don't care about this algebra. I'm going to just disengage. Hmm. But the one thing I point out, and we all had friends in school that might have been disengaged in one topic or another in school, but then they would go home and they would be addicted to a video game, or they would play a sport all day or all night, or they'd become obsessed with the game. So they weren't inherently demotivated people. In fact, I'd argue the great majority of people can be very, very, very motivated about something if it's presented to them in the right way. And the video game industry has obviously fine-tuned the science of how do you motivate people. And so there is a dimension of including game mechanics, really good game mechanics in the learning process. And some people kind of cringe, oh, game mechanics and learning, that sounds, oh, I don't know, learning should be about learning. And what I point out is our system today actually already does have game mechanics. It's just very bad game mechanics. Grades are game mechanics. Do this or you're going to get a bad grade. Attendance is a bad grade mechanic. Show up and pretend like you're listening, otherwise we're going to flunk you, or you're going to do this. Those are bad game mechanics. There are much more positive game mechanics you can do, things like badging, things like points. You can have intrinsic mechanics where the students go on a learning quest. And so these are the type of things that we think we can start to incorporate. And we're at the very early stages of what we're doing, but we're already seeing it. And it could be something as simple as a video. You know, we have LeBron James had reached out to us, and he wanted to help make videos with us. So we have a whole collection of videos where he asks interesting science questions, and we think about how we can actually address those things.
My guest is Salman Khan. He is founder of the Khan Academy and author of the new book, The One World Schoolhouse, Education Reimagined. We'll come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join it by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Salman Khan, founder of the Khan Academy and author of the new book, The One World Schoolhouse, Education Reimagined. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have Lori on the line next in Richardson. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to thank you for putting those videos out there. My son is a junior in high school, and he's been using the Khan Academy videos for 3 years now to get through his honors and pre-AP math classes. And I don't think without those videos he would have come this far. I think he would have given up sooner just because those classes move so fast. The higher level classes are very fast-paced, and I think that he's really needed that extra time and attention that your videos have given him. So I appreciate that you've done all this.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's great to hear, and I appreciate that you appreciate it. And you know, things like that is what keep me and the rest of our team really motivated.
How carefully do you try to track with what would be happening, say, in a calculus class in an American high school and the way that concepts are taught there?
Yeah, and it actually even brings a kind of a broader question of standards. You know, famously, you know, the Common Core passed multiple states before you had each of the states had their different standards. And our view is because we're able to, the content is in these kind of granular chunks, and it's not just video content, it's also interactive exercises. But they're very granular, and to some degree, they apply to every standard. And our goal is to cover be exhaustive and be a superset of pretty much any of the major standards, so that it's as useful as it in the U.S. as it is in Singapore or India or the U.K. And so, our goal is to definitely cover everything that people would see in most calculus courses or most biology courses or most art history courses.
Yeah, so we've talked about art, and we've talked about science, and we've talked about mathematics. Talk about subjects that lend themselves best to the methods of instruction that you have on your site and the ones that have been more of a struggle to develop materials for.
So Khan Academy, it started, I talk a lot in the book, in algebra and geometry and your traditional math classes. It now goes into math classes that are well into college, differential equations and sciences, biology, organic chemistry. So it seems like the traditional math and sciences, people are finding value there. We also have some folks who are doing art history videos where they're doing conversations about some of this content. And so the general sense is, in any domain where there might be a need for an explanation or to hear two people talk about something or more than two people talk about something, the videos can be useful. On the exercise side of Khan Academy, obviously we've made a lot of exercises that can ask someone to solve an equation or to figure out what will happen to a rock as it falls to the ground. A more interesting question is, how do you do subjective type assessment? Mm-hmm. How do you have someone write an essay or do a piece of art, and can you assess that thing? And we aren't doing it a lot right now because we're attacking so much of the objective initially, but we do think there's a reality, especially this was the beauty of the internet, where people can create something, and we already had this on our computer science. Someone can create their own novel work of computer science, and then other people can comment on them. Soon other people can kind of give feedback on it, and we can imagine something very similar happening in creative writing or the visual arts or music composition.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line we have Raj in Dallas. Hi, Raj.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to personally thank Mr. Khan for taking on this fantastic mission. My question has to do with the fact that, right now a large focus of the Khan Academy, as I see it, is mostly K-12 education, with certainly a few courses with advanced subjects. I wanted to get a sense from Mr. Khan, how do you envision Khan Academy expanding to more advanced subjects like medicine or law or finance? And as a corollary to that, how do you envision finding collaborators from these fields to, can I one day be able to say I'm getting my MBA from Khan Academy or a master's in finance? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Great question, Raj. There's a couple of dimensions to it. So one, to answer some of it, we do have some college content already. We actually are already doing medical content. We have a gentleman, Rishi Desai, who's a real doctor, who is taking time off to produce essentially the first 2 years of medical school on the Khan Academy. And right now it's the video side, but eventually we want interactive exercises so that anyone can really learn that content. I also, my background is in finance. I have an MBA, and so I actually would like the core knowledge that you would normally associate with an MBA or a CFA or CPA, that you can get that on Khan Academy. I think that's it's not only valuable vocationally, but it's actually just valuable to participate as a citizen, to understand what's going on in the world. So simple answer for all of that is yes. I think the other dimension that you're touching on, and we will continue to look for other people who could do that type of content, the other dimension you're talking about is, education is several things. And they tend to be muddled together. There's a learning side of things, which Khan Academy is addressing right now. There's a socialization side of things, and we touched on a little bit with the community on the site. But then there's the credentialing. Mm-hmm. And frankly, and I talk a lot of it in the book, that's what a lot of times people pay for. They want to be credentialed so that they can get a job or even a spouse, I guess. And so what we think at Khan Academy is we see a reality where the credential will get decoupled from the learning, so that regardless of how you learn something, you can prove to the world you know it. Whether you learned it at Harvard, your community college, or online, or through a textbook, you can prove that you know it as good as anybody. And we are starting to explore that, to work with other people to figure out, can we create these world-recognized, these internationally recognized credentials, micro-credentials, to prove that you have a skill in creative writing, or in world history, or in computer programming?
Do you think we overvalue particularly universities as credential factories right now?
Well, it's an open question. I think, there's a strange disconnect, and there's a whole chapter on this in the book, between if you ask a university why they're charging what they charge, and they say, we give this great academic experience, look at our facilities, look at the research, all of that. But if you ask students or parents why they're going into debt and why they're taking all this time. Sure, they like the experience. We all liked our college experiences, but the reason why they view it as a must-have, there are other good experiences. You can go to Europe for a year, or you can go meditate, but the reason why they want to have this experience is because they know, or at least they perceive that credential to be a ticket to a profession or a white-collar job. And as a thought experiment, imagine going to the graduation at Harvard and picking a random kid and saying, look, you had your experience at Harvard, you get to keep it, but I'll refund all your tuition. You could just never tell anyone that you went to Harvard. And I think you would have very few takers, which proves that they were really paying for the credential, for the ability to say, I have a degree in such and such from that university. And so I do see a reality where you decouple that thing, where you can get the credential however you prove, however you learn the material, and that credential will mean more because we already know that a Bachelor of Science and whatever, doesn't necessarily even, as an employer, sometimes we don't know what that actually means, and then we put some through another rigorous interview process. So those credentials will carry more weight, we have more economic value, and they would be cheaper for the student. And it's up to the student to decide, do they want to go to a four-year university, do they want to go to a community college, or do they want to learn some other way through an apprenticeship or from textbooks.
Let's go next on the phone to Suzanne in Dallas. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi,
go right ahead, please.
Dr. Bone.
You know what? I'm so sorry, Suzanne. You're breaking up. I see the description of her question, though, Salman. She was curious about whether there's an age limit, whether you have a lot of adult learners, and I guess you have quite a few.
Yeah. And I touched on this a lot in the book, and this is a big discovery for me, and actually touches on Raj's question as well. In 2001, right from the get-go, when I looked at the data, we had a disproportionate number of people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and up who were using the content. I would get testimonials. Sometimes they just were curious. They wanted to keep their kind of a brain agile. Sometimes they wanted to help their kids or their grandchildren. But then during the financial crisis, and my background was in finance, I started putting up finance videos to explain what a credit default swap is or what liquidity versus insolvency is. And tons of people, including many in the finance profession, somewhat scarily, I got a message from someone at an investment bank, I won't say which one, that said, thank you for that video on mortgage-backed securities. I now know what I do for a living. And so, there's tons of adults that are using it, many of them going back to school, but many of them just want to kind of understand the world around them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Nikhil in Plano. Hi, Nikhil.
Hi, this is Nikhil. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was going to ask on the socialization aspect. I think you touched on it earlier. If there is any movement towards adoption of this at the school level and colleges level that is kind of formal, so they're actually taking it up and asking people to take these classes before they come to class, like you had alluded to earlier, but in a more formal kind of way.
So there are a bunch of schools that are using it. Every school is using it in a slightly different way. And for us, it's really just to discover what seems to be working and what doesn't seem to work in different contexts. Famously, in the book, I write about Los Altos being the first that started using Khan Academy. They now use it on a district-wide basis. Los Altos is out here in Northern California for their 5th through 8th graders. There's 20,000 classrooms around the country that are using Khan Academy in some way, shape, or form, many of them in Texas. On top of that, the university level, we have heard of many universities either using us, especially for the introductory courses, supplements, or even integrated in a deeper way. But I think the fun thing, and this is what the book is about, is we're seeing hopefully Khan Academy has been a catalyst for people to rethink what the physical experience has been about. I was on a panel with John Hennessy, the president of Stanford, and he was very clear that he's like, yeah, we have to think seriously about removing lectures from the classroom, not to remove the classroom experience, but to make it actually more interactive. We talk about education as socialization, but in most classrooms right now, the socialization is sit passively, don't say a word, take notes, and try to let this information pour into your head. And we think the real socialization is, no, come to class, get engaged, work with your teacher, work with your peers, and actually learn the material.
Are you thinking about opportunities for students to interact with one another through the site as they're sort of going through these classes? Is there sort of a social media thought to all of this?
Yeah, we're starting on that. I think it's very primitive right now. When I talk to the team, and we are 36 people now, I say, look, Khan Academy is like a train station where any given moment we have tens of thousands of people at the site at any moment. There's 7 million who use it on a monthly basis. but they can't see each other. They can't hear each other. And they could work with each other if we just gave them the tools to do it. So we've started to give some basic community. People can ask questions on the side. Other people will answer it. But I do imagine a reality in over the next several years where you could go to Khan Academy, and if you're having trouble, you can immediately get help. You can immediately get tutoring from one of the other thousands of people who are at the site that exact second.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Southlake. We have Tim on the line there. Hi, Tim.
Hi. My question is really with the current economics of our school and our budget, particularly here in Texas, but I assume also in California, I know it is, can we really change the system so we aren't going to school as little as we do? I live in Asia. They go to school many more weeks out of the year. Do we have the will, capability, or finances to make it happen?
Yeah, you know, out of the will, capability, and finances, there's a whole chapter in the book about this. It's actually the will is the only thing that is an open question. You know, I point out in many school districts, if you just do a back of the envelope on the finances, on the East Coast schools, you know, New York City public schools famously spends $18,000 per student per year. Other parts of the country, it can easily get to $10,000. Even some of the places that spend less, it's $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 per student per year, but they have a 30-to-1 student teacher ratio. So we're talking on the order of, depending on which of those you look at, $200,000 to $500,000 or more per classroom of students. And very little of that right now is actually going for the teacher salary or the teacher benefits. And so the money is definitely there. The resources are definitely there. You know, a lot of what we talk about with technology, people wonder, hey, can we do it? But if you don't even have to have one computer per child, because we don't think that a child could be on the computer all day. You could have one computer for every five children. If a computer now costs $300, it lasts for 5 years, and that's $60 per year. And if five kids are using it, that's $12 per student per year. That's cheaper than textbooks. And so I would say the will is the important thing. What I'm excited about personally and optimistic about is we're now in a stage where you don't have to go through the traditional gatekeepers, you don't have to go through the traditional publishers, or you don't have to go top down through school districts. The adoption we're seeing is a very bottoms up adoption. I mean, you hear some of the callers, the tool is there, they didn't have to ask anyone's permission. Teachers are using it on their own, parents are using it on their own, administrators are using it on their own. And as more people use it and they tell other people, I think it'll just kind of create a groundswell. That's my hope.
So, of course, we are a media company dedicated to lifelong learning here, and we're always raising money. How's that side of things going for you?
Yes, we are also raising money as a not-for-profit, so if anyone is feeling generous, they should go to khanacademy.org and donate. But, you know, our view is, you know, we are philanthropically supported. We think there might be ways to generate revenue that don't conflict with our mission. Some companies are licensing our content for other products. Sesame Street has licensed Elmo quite well. I don't know if I would quite have the same appeal. The doll might be called Unibrow or something like that. But we're exploring what we can do. But, you know, the pitch on the philanthropic side of all scale, whether people are donating $5 or more or $500, is, you know, it's hard to find a higher social return on investment because we can reach so many millions for the content we're trying to produce.
Salman Khan is founder of the Khan Academy, which you can find online at khanacademy.org. His new book is The One World Schoolhouse, Education Reimagined. Salman, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.